Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court kicked off its new term this week. Justices plan to hear cases on a number of controversial issues, including abortion, guns, immigration, separation of church and state, and the Electoral College, plus workplace discrimination and sexual orientation. On Tuesday, they heard oral arguments over the meaning of sex when it comes to LGBTQ workers. At issue is whether employers can fire, for example, gay employees based on their sexual orientation or transgender workers due to their gender identity. Ryan Owens is a political science professor and the director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. His areas of expertise include the U.S. Supreme Court. Ryan, good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. I just read a list of, you know, basically all the hot button issues in American politics. Do we usually see this cluster of that kind of controversial issue hitting the Supreme Court all at once?
Yeah, not typically. I mean, it's usually the case that the court will hear two or three really big cases that, you know, everybody can kind of get mobilized on. This one is a little bit different. As you said, we've got this whole cluster of big issues. And, you know, as everybody knows, this is coming up in an election year, too. So, I mean, this is it's a bit of a tinderbox.
So they're starting to hear arguments now. Do I have this right? Decisions usually come out like the following June-ish? Or does that depend?
Yes and no. So about a third of all the court's opinions come down the last 2 weeks of its term, which is usually in June. And those typically are the real big cases. But two-thirds of those other cases are released throughout the course. Now, they just started the court's term this week on Monday. It'll take some time, of course, to write the opinions and stuff. So we won't see any opinions probably come down from the court for at least another month, maybe 2 months.
Do justices, from what we know, look over their shoulder at a looming big presidential election? Does that weigh on their minds as they're deciding a controversial issue?
Well, it does. I hesitate to say that it systematically does, but we clearly have evidence in the historical record that justices have considered this. So in 1992, when the court was determining whether to hear the Casey decision, right, whether to take that up, the liberal justices pushed very hard for the court to release its opinion before that election because they thought that the court was going to whittle back on abortion and they wanted people to be able to vote on that issue. Chief Justice Rehnquist originally, I think, wanted to slow play that a little bit, and the liberal justices forced his hand on it. Ultimately, the court didn't rule in the way that people thought it would in the case, but it is an indication that, yes, they are paying attention to what's going on politically, and at times they will force an issue if it's big enough.
And before we get into some of the particular cases they're hearing, I've seen some analysis about the role of precedent and how willing at least some of the judges would be to overturn precedent, especially of past Supreme Court rulings. So they're looking at their reading of the law, of course, but looking at the weight of what has come before them in the Supreme Court. How willing are justices to steer the craft in a different way, even if there's no new really developments in that?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd say two things on it. One is, we really should want justices to adhere to precedent as often as they can. The notion of stability in the law is really crucial. We need to have that. So I think that's the first thing. Like our goal is to try to have stability in the law. Now, having said that, there are, of course, clearly instances where justices should go back or at least rethink existing precedent. Now, in that vein, you know, it always depends on whose ox is getting gored. The biggest proponents of precedent are those who have won victories in the past and they want to keep it there. So it shouldn't surprise any of us that last term we heard a lot about precedent from Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, right? Because they want to protect the existing precedents in areas like abortion. And conversely, you know, the conservative justices will weigh heavily, you know, when they're thinking about precedents that maybe they would favor. So, you know, part of this is whose ox is getting gored, but you know, we should really want them to pay a lot of attention to precedent because it's meaningful.
Talking to Ryan Owens from UW-Madison, looking at a new session of the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, let's start with the case that they've already heard oral arguments on, a few different workplace discrimination allegations here coming up to the court based on a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender identity. What's at stake in this case?
Well, so the first thing to note is that this is a statutory interpretation question. The question here is whether or not a federal statute which makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of sex incorporates sexual orientation in it. So this is not a constitutional case. It is a statutory interpretation case. And that sometimes does affect how justices decide a case. So they can say, for example, you know, if we get this wrong, Congress can always come in and clean up that mess later. If we interpret a statute the way they didn't want us to, they can come back and repass that statute. So that should operate in the background here as we think about this case. Now, the question is, does sexual orientation sort of naturally and reasonably fall within this definition of on the basis of sex? There are a couple of things that are unquestioned in this case. And the first is that when Congress passed this statute in the 1960s, there is no doubt whatsoever that they did not intend for this to be considered. Right. No question about it. In fact, medical dictionaries called homosexuality, you know, a medical disease at the time. So it's undoubted that Congress did not have this in mind. Now, the question is, can the text be interpreted broadly enough to include sexual orientation in here? And this is why I brought up the whole statutory interpretation question, because I don't think it's an altogether implausible view for somebody to argue that sexual orientation could be considered in there. There's an argument to be made there. It may or may not be a strong argument, depending on your perspective. But I do think that the court looks at this and says, hey, this is going to be a sea change in the law. If we include sexual orientation within this, that is a pretty monumental decision, and maybe we're not the ones that ought to be making these kinds of huge decisions. And I think they'll look at things like Congress recently passing Sexual Orientation Equality Act, at least the House did, and that's evidence to suggest that members of Congress don't think that this sexual orientation folds within on the basis of sex. And you also see a number of states over the last decade or so passing a lot of statutes that ban sexual orientation discrimination. If it's the case that you can just fold that right in with on the basis of sex, it would render all of those statutes or attempted statutes superfluous. So I think the justices are very cautious about pushing out on this boundary, particularly when there's been so much activity in the legislatures on it. I would not be surprised to see the justices say in this case, it's a bridge too far for us to go, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
And people have been paying attention to Justice Gorsuch on this one. And with this kind of how you interpret statute laws passed by Congress, there's two different schools of thought. One is we need to look at the intent of lawmakers at the time. I'm oversimplifying, I'm sure. And one is, no, look at the letters, look at the words that they wrote. And Gorsuch's view to somebody says, look at the words. And people looked at what happened in the oral argument and thought, he could be a swing vote in a surprising way. What do you think of that?
Well, just one quick point is there are actually three schools of thought on this. One is to look at the intent. One is to look at the text, and particularly what the framers of the text meant when they passed it. And the third is just to look at the text today and kind of think whatever you think it means today, right? And that's sort of what's called the living constitution approach to things. The textualists in this case, it's unclear. There's not a particularly strong case to be made one way or the other on this. I think in this case, whether you're a textualist, whether you believe in intent, or whether you're just a living constitutionalist, it's going to come down to what the justices are most comfortable with. And I know that sounds a little strange when we're talking about lawyers and judges, but I think that's ultimately where it comes down. I think you're going to have a number of justices say, how we feel about this issue is irrelevant. What's important here is the institutional question. Which institution is better off deciding this case? And, you know, on that score, I do think that you're going to have probably five votes lined up to say, let's let Congress take care of this.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that Congress could, if you could get agreement on it from both chambers and both parties, in effect, sometimes a tall order, they could nail this down. Yeah, when we say on the basis of sex, we include sexual orientation, for example.
That's right. And I think the question there is, should the courts look at congressional will on this issue? I think the answer to that is no. We're talking about institutional prerogatives here. And if this is something that's best left to the legislature, I don't think they look at that secondary question of whether this particular legislature is defunct.
Talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's new term with Ryan Owens, political science professor, director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. Let's move on to some of the other issues coming up. I don't think we're going to get to all of them because there's a lot. But an abortion case, this one coming, I think, from Louisiana on admitting privileges in abortion clinics. Texas had done something like this. The Supreme Court a few years back struck down their version of law, pretty similar law from Louisiana. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's not altogether clear what's going on here, frankly. So as you mentioned, the Louisiana law is very similar to the Texas law that the Supreme Court struck by 5-3 a couple of years ago. So this was Scalia was out. He had passed away. And Justice Kennedy sided with the liberals in that case to strike down the Texas statute. It's unclear what exactly is going on here. I mean, we do know one thing. It looks like Louisiana said, now is the time for us. Right? We're going to try to push this as far as we can because it looks like the timing is right. So they pushed this case forward. In the meantime, Chief Justice Roberts here did vote with the liberals to put a stay on that statute while the court prepares to hear this case. So, what's going on there? My guess is he put that stay on it because Louisiana sort of, it was an affront, I think, to the court and the court's decision. So, where are people going to come out in this case? I don't know. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the court could summarily reverse this lower court decision, not even, give us an extensive opinion, just say, this is so much like this previous case out of Texas that we're just going to reverse you summarily. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I am not convinced that the court is going to use this case as one to substantially redefine abortion doctrine. It just seems unusual. It just doesn't feel right to me. It's so quickly after the other one.
Right. So the only circumstance that really has changed here is we have a different justice who might vote the other way. Is that kind of how people are looking at this?
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of history with Justice Kavanaugh on abortion. So I think people are just trying to see what's going to happen. I mean, this is one of these, canary in the mine cases and see where it can go. Frankly, I would be surprised if the court uses this as the case where it really is going to cut back to the extent that it decides it wants to cut back on abortion rights anytime in the next few years.
On the precedent question, a lot of people are looking at Justice Roberts in cases like these thinking, okay, maybe he would in normal circumstances vote on one side, but he's looking at it saying, hey, you took this to my court a few years back. I'm not gonna flip that precedent that my court just did a few years ago.
Yeah, he is the most institutionalist of the justices, if I can say that. And not surprisingly, he's the chief. Historically, this is going to fall on his shoulders. So I think that's right. And just, put yourself in Roberts' position here for a second. The court is, getting attacked by both sides right now. He's trying to stay above the fray. He's trying to protect the legacy and the institutional support that the court has. And now he may be dragged into impeachment proceedings as well. He will have to preside over any Senate impeachment inquiry hearing in which, the president is involved. So, you could have a circumstance where Roberts has to go in the afternoon on one day and preside over this trial and the next day hear a case that involves the president. This has to be weighing on him a little bit. And I think he will take into consideration some of these extra legal considerations.
This is an issue that could come before the court. It's not there yet, but Congress wants stuff from the executive branch. The executive branch doesn't want to give them that stuff. Ultimately, yeah. This could go really quickly, potentially, to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we saw that with the Nixon impeachment. The court rendered a decision in that case that in a criminal proceeding, the president's ability to use executive privilege as a shield is not unqualified, that in a criminal proceeding, courts have access to these materials for a host of reasons. It could be a similar case that comes before the Supreme Court now over this matter. We'll have to see.
In the public eye, we have Democratic and Republican Supreme Court justices. I'm sure a Supreme Court justice would slap you for saying that, but but that's the view. Is it that simple if a case like a contest between House Democrats and a Republican president comes to the Supreme Court?
No, it's not that simple at all. And I would get slapped if I made that argument. What we have here are judicial philosophies. And I think it is safe to say that there tends to be a correlation between ideological proclivities and certain judicial philosophies. But it is the philosophy that drives the outcome for these justices and not partisanship. And frankly, look, I've said this before, too. Donald Trump is no conservative, right? He is by no means a conservative as classically defined. So most of these justices are well-trained in conservative and liberal political thought. They know what it means to be a conservative or a liberal philosophically. And so, even if there are partisan affiliations with members of Congress and the president, those same affiliations do not exist with nominees to the High Court and the president.
Do we have a lot of precedent in recent years with most of these justices when it comes to balance of power issues between the White House, whoever's in it, and Congress, whoever's running it?
We've had some decisions. Honestly, the real indicator would have been a couple of terms ago with the DACA case. Now, we've got a case this term where we're going to reevaluate portions of that. But if ever there was a case in which you would have established somebody's bona fides in terms of the separation of powers, it would have been that one. I think there is a very, very legitimate case to be made that the president's use of DACA and DAPA, President Obama, was incredibly unconstitutional, if I can put an adverb before that. It was a power grab by the executive branch that I think was unheralded and unconstitutional. It would have been interesting to see what the liberal justices did. And so often we look at the conservative and say, well, when are they going to break with the president? We can't forget that there are four liberals who are fairly doctrinaire on this court as well. And it would have been interesting to see how they would have operated in that case, whether they would have voted against Obama or not, just as it'll be interesting in this term to see what happens with the conservative justices and Trump in this immigration case.
Well, let's stay with the deferred action for childhood arrivals. President Trump tweeted yesterday that he wants the court to strike it down. I'll quote here, if the Supreme Court upholds DACA, it gives the president extraordinary powers far greater than ever thought. They do what is right and not let it stand with all its negative legal implications. Republicans and Democrats will have a deal to let them stay in our country in very short order. So the president arguing against presidential powers in a way.
Yeah, well, that's rich. Given the emergency, action that he wanted to take at the border, I mean, I think that was just as excessive as Obama's unconstitutional actions were. But we will see what happens in this case. He is trying to use his authority, his discretionary authority, to wind down an existing existing DACA and DAPA cases. The key here, of course, is that their stated rationale, at least first, for revoking this or winding it down was that they thought it was illegal and unconstitutional. And what the challenger said was that's a legal question, and it's up to courts to make that determination. And if you do that as your sole decision, you're actually not exercising a policy decision. You're exercising a legal one. So we don't have to defer to your policy judgment on this matter. Ultimately, I'm not sure how much it's going to matter. There are policy and legal interpretations sort of wound up in this decision. My guess would be that the court says this is more of a policy decision that the president has the authority to undo.
Looking at a new session of the U.S. Supreme Court with Ryan Owens from UW-Madison. I want to give a listen to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, asked by NPR during an event in New York recently why she didn't retire when Barack Obama was still president. She says she's been asked that a lot. Here's a listen to some of what she had to say.
When that suggestion is made, I ask the questioner, who do you think that the president could nominate that could get through the Republican Senate that you would prefer to have on the court than me?
So Justice Ginsburg, a lot of eyes on her. She's 86, just finished radiation treatment for a tumor on her pancreas. One of the more gruesome parts of observing the Supreme Court is looking at older court members. Talk about her significance on the court.
Yeah, well, honestly, there's a lot of hubris, I think, in that comment. It's not up to her to decide what the Republican Senate would approve of or not approve of. The question is, are you fit to remain in that office? Should you retire? And I think, I think we as citizens should be very, very skeptical of people who think that they can serve in that capacity until death takes them. There should be a little bit more regular rotation in that position. Now, given her situation on the bench right now, yeah, I don't think there's any chance that she's voluntarily going to leave this court, certainly not with this president. But, if she does pass away or something happens and she has to leave the court, all hell is going to break loose. You think it's polarized right now. Just imagine what happens if we have impeachment and then a vacancy on the court.
Just 30 seconds, we say we need more rotation. Do we need something like a term limit system on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to a term limit system. I think the court packing plans that are being offered are silly and stupid. But I do think that rotation in office from a term limit is not a bad idea. As long as it's lengthy enough that you can ensure judicial independence, then I think it's something to look into.
Ryan, thanks. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Owens, political science professor and director of the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. We previewed the U.S. Supreme Court's new term. Among the issues at play, abortion, gay rights, guns, immigration, presidential power, and separation of church and state.